Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled A Palace of Our Own by Lama Cathy Wesley. The new decorations in the main meditation hall at Columbus KTC have sparked several conversations. What is the symbolism of the designs and the colors? How do these designs affect our practice and our meditation and outlook? Using the oral teachings of Kempo Karta Rinpoche as a guide, Lama Cathy explains how the designs allow us all to have an inner palace of our own. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming today. Today's talk is called A Palace of Our Own, and it seeks to answer some questions you might have about this room. And it's the beginning of a two-part series on what awakening is, what Buddhahood is, what the qualities of Buddhahood are, and how we actually already possess these qualities of Buddhahood within us. And so that's a little bit about what we're going to start with today. We usually begin with a prayer, and the prayer of taking refuge is right there with you. I will recite it two times in the English language and then chant it one time in Tibetan. This is a prayer that, even if you're not familiar with the meaning of it, you can kind of get with the spirit of it, because the spirit of it is thinking, I'm pretty lucky to be alive, and I have a lot of gratitude for my life, and I would like to spend it benefiting beings and making the world better. So if that's something you can internalize while we're taking refuge in the Buddha as the teacher, the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as the community, that's cool. So it begins with the words, in the Buddha. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly, most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly, most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O Sanje Chudan Soji Chonahamla Jang Chu Pardu Tani Kyap Suchi Daji Chin Soji Bei Sunaham Ki Drola Pinchir Sanjay Druparsho. Okay, I'll say a short prayer of my own and then we'll begin. O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi War Pe De Ten Shula Kadren Jembo Gane Je Sun Te Kusum Tugging A Drup Sal Du So. Okay, thanks very much. Today, I'd like to start by welcoming you, and if you're here for the first time, thanking you for being here as part of our Dharma Talk group. It's always delightful to be part of what's happening here, and some of you may or may not have been here last week when we sort of unveiled the new decorating. I don't know what you think. It's a little different. And I'm going to be explaining some of the symbolism of the new decorations today, as well as talking a little bit about their meaning and so forth. But to begin with, I'm going to have us do just a short meditation where I'm going to actually read a short guided meditation from Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's book, White Tara, The Wish-Fulfilling Wheel, The Practice of White Tara. And so I'm going to invite you to join me in a circle of protection in a palace that is created in Vajrayana Buddhism by the texts. The lamas have written texts about the qualities of enlightenment, and they've described these qualities of enlightenment as having form. They can have a form, and the form looks like a vast palace. And so I'm going to encourage you to kind of close your eyes and follow along. We'll begin by doing just a short bit of quiet sitting meditation, allowing our attention to fall upon the breath and to stay with the breath as the breath comes and goes. So we'll do that for about a minute, and then I'll begin to read to you this description of a Buddha palace. In Sanskrit, the mantra Om Swabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma Swabhava Shuddha Hung means all things are empty in their essence, and so am I. We rest momentarily in emptiness and then recollect that while all things are empty, that is, without inherent existence, this isn't to say that they are nothing. As a sign of that, from the state of inseparable emptiness and wisdom, as an expression of that emptiness, the essence of your mind arises as the sound of home. This is thought of being sacred sound. From this comes an encircling, protective vajra fence and tent around where you are sitting. It's the appearance of mind and nothing other than mind. And we do this part of the practice when we're doing a Vajrayana mantra practice in order to remind ourselves that while we think of emptiness as being a lack of something, as nothing, it is in fact, it is the nature of all things and allows for all things to appear. So we think that beneath us is a crossed vajra. And you can just imagine that we have a floor beneath us as we sit that has a blue floor in front of us, a red floor to our right, I'm sorry, a yellow floor to our right, a red floor behind us, and a green floor to our left. Even if you can't see the colors, just see all the colors of the rainbow beneath you. Around you, there is a fence of vajras that go encircle you completely. And this floor and fence are as vast as all of space, covering you and protecting you is a tent, a beautiful tent also made of vajras that interlock. So now in this safe and protected environment, you can practice mantra practice. But there's more. Now, in the center of this circle of protection is another mantra sound, the sound of drung. It transforms where you are sitting into a vast palace that is square, that is tall, that it has four doors, four entrances on each of the four directions. One door to the east, one door to the south, one to the west, and one to the north. The palace has four sides and four doors facing the cardinal direction, each with a large doorway. And emerging from each of these doorways is a portico, a covered entrance. The palace has a single large chamber and is square. Above the walls is a space, and above this is a ceremonial four-sided pagoda-shaped roof with an elaborate cornice that goes around the perimeter of the building and extends slightly beyond it. The roof is supported by four crossbeams which rest on the walls above the door frames, and four octagonal pillars which are situated around the central part of the floor. The pillars are made from precious gems and are beautiful. All of this is made of light, brilliantly luminous inside and outside. The four sides of the palace symbolize the four immeasurables: love, compassion, joy, and impartiality. The four doors facing the four cardinal directions signify the fulfillment of four enlightened activities: pacifying the sufferings of beings, enriching sentient beings, magnetizing sentient beings, and subduing danger. The space between the top of the walls and the roof symbolizes emptiness. Hanging in the empty space are garlands of precious gems and draperies. This symbolizes that emptiness does not mean nothingness. There is wisdom in this emptiness. The bells hanging down symbolize that within emptiness, the Dharma is being taught effortlessly. And in the center of the palace, you can imagine yourself as a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, whichever one you wish. You are made of light, just like the palace, and you radiate the qualities of enlightenment. You could be Tara, you could be Chenrezig, you could be the Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. But for the purpose of this meditation, you are in a circle of protection, a grand palace that symbolizes all of the qualities of Buddhahood. And you are manifesting your Buddha nature in the form of a Buddha. You can open your eyes and look around, because that's what has been created in this room. The palace is here. This is a palace. Our pillars are not octagonal, but they stand in the center of the room. And this space of emptiness that is covered with draperies and ringing bells, that is what is symbolized by the paper, the design at the top of the wall. Above that are beautiful clouds signifying the sky. The yellow color is the color of enrichment, and the color of qualities, which we all possess. And the five colors that you see reflected in these designs that have been placed in the room are symbolic of the five kinds of Buddha wisdom. And in essence, we've created a palace of our own here. And it mirrors the palace that exists within each one of us, which is our Buddha nature. And that is the symbolism, that's the symbolism of this room. This room is a palace. And by sitting in this artificially created room, it reflects what we really are inside, which is full of richness. Right now, we relate to ourselves as sometimes confused sentient beings. Sometimes we have confusion, sometimes we have a little bit of wisdom, and then confusion takes over again. But for the purposes of meditation, we imagine that we are in a different world. We imagine that we are in the world of the protection circle. We imagine that we're in the world of the awakened palace, which is symbolic of love, compassion, joy, equanimity, and all of the qualities of love and wisdom that are part of Buddhahood. And so rooms like this are created to reflect our inner richness. And that's why they're so colorful, and that's why they're so, they have such power and intensity, is because they reflect all of the goodness that's inside of us. So thank you for letting me take you on that little tour of a palace. But I want to say a couple more things about the idea of a palace of our own. All of us have an environment around us every day. We have an outer environment. We got an inner environment. All of these, this environment is created by our mind and by our experience and by our karma and by our habitual tendencies. Right now, the world we have, it has some aspects of awakening to it, but it also has some mundane aspects. We have family, we have friends, we have coworkers, we have our home, we have where we are residing, we have where we work, we have all these places in our life. And we relate to them from a place of self-centeredness. It's our family, our home, our place, our experience. And so it increases our attachment when we interact with our mundane world. It increases our attachment. I want more of this, or I want more of that. And we become, I guess you could say, slaves to our possessions. Or we become slaves to our interior notions about things. And so these worlds that are created in the practices of mantra and visualization, they are also artificial constructs. But it is a different artificial construct in that we're told to meditate that it's made of light and empty inside, so that we can't possibly grasp and hold on to it as something real and permanent and unchanging that we will somehow keep or somehow lose. You can't lose an imaginary palace. Nobody can take it away from you. It's yours. It's your place. And so I think of the genius of this type of meditation sometimes. I think how smart it is. It's almost like the enlightened beings in creating these meditations and these imaginary worlds recognize that we have fixation and selfishness and do everything they can to take that selfishness and subvert it by turning it into a sacred universe that we are then part of. They subvert it by making it insubstantial. They subvert it by making it not about us as the owner, but us as the Buddha that manifests this palace. Because the palace and all of these constructs are, their origin is in the Buddha and Bodhisattva, him or herself. And so you might ask, well, what's the benefit of doing mantra practice? What's the benefit of creating an imaginary world? Well, for me, the first benefit is it replaces the other imaginary world I live in, which is my daily life. Because in my daily life, I have friends, I have people who I think are out to get me, you know, I mean, you know, right? So we all have stories in our mind about our mundane life. And it reminds me of the first words of the Buddha's Book of Sayings, the Dhammapada, where he says, we are what we think. That's powerful. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts, we make our world. So this means that we have a part in creating our experience. And we can change that experience by changing the way we think about it. We can think of everything as being mundane and confused and mine or not mine and good or not good and so on. We can grasp toward it in this way, but we could also say it's a Buddha palace, it's for all beings. May all beings benefit from this. And so what it is that we're working on new habits. I don't know if you've read the wonderful book called Karma. It's all about karma, what it is, what it isn't, and why it matters, by Trolak Rinpoche. It's just a little book, little thin book like this. And it's got on the cover, it's got the word karma in big letters because a lot of people are interested in it. So I guess you could say it's a bit of an attention grabber. Inside that book, he explains the Buddha's theories about karma, that what we do a lot, we do a lot. What we think a lot, we think a lot. The way we react a lot is how we react a lot. But that these habits, which are the glue that holds our experience of the world together, these habits, which are called, in Tibetan, they're called bak. Chak. What a great word, bak chak. B-A-K-C-H-A-K. Bak chak means habitual pattern or habitual tendency. And my teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, when we were struggling with all the mantra practices of the three-year retreat, of which there are many, they're incredibly elaborate with incredible palaces just like this one. And lots of things to visualize. It kind of breaks your brain after a while. And we said, well, why are we doing all of this? And he said, because every minute of every day, you are making bak chak. You are making habits. Habits of thinking about yourself, habits of thinking about the world, habits of reacting to yourself, reacting to the world. You're making habits every single minute of every single day. And this retreat is about replacing mundane habits with supramundane or extraordinary or sacred habits, so that those sacred habits eventually begin to outweigh the mundane ones. And that was like a little light bulb moment for me. If all I'm doing is making habits, then what I do, think, and say on a regular basis, that's kind of important. And I guess I'm going to give this a whirl. I'm going to give this mantra practice a chance to work on me. So every day in meditation, I would sit in my imaginary palace in my imaginary world, being an imaginary Buddha and doing imaginary good, virtuous things for all beings. At the end of each session of meditation, it would all dissolve into emptiness, and I would be alone with my mind. And I would see that it's kind of quiet. after all of that visualization, all of that sacred interplay of color and so and sound and so forth. And that any time I wished, I could be that Buddha anywhere, anytime. And so this is how mantra practice gradually, day by day, moment by moment, changes our interior monologue from me, 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 to sacred, sacred, sacred. So that's a little bit about this room and about why we made it like this, to reflect on the, I guess, almost subliminal level, the qualities of awakening that's within each one of us. And to encourage people to look within themselves and to find those qualities, to look within themselves and train in benefiting others, and so on. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Kempo Karthar Rinpoche said, we may think of them as archetypes or symbols, but he said they're real. They are real beings who lived at one place in one time and who come when we call them. And he said that's why holy places are holy places and holy people are holy people, because they invite the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to be with them over and over and over again. And when we are in the presence of these imagined Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, what do? We ask them to bless us, to change us, to adjust us from the inside. We imagine that light shines from their forms and touches us, and it purifies us of all of our faults, all of our failings, all of our impurities, all of our bad habits, all of our bad karma. In essence, we give these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas permission to purify us. We give them permission to allow them to purify us so that we can allow ourselves to heal from our faults, to heal from our failings, to heal from our bad habits, our selfish habits, and to become something more. And so this is the function of all of these mantra practices, whether it's Buddha of wisdom, Manjushri, the Buddha of compassion, Chenrezig, the Buddha of active compassion, Tara, the Buddha of medicine, Sanjay Menla. All of these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas serve a purpose to help us heal that which is within us. And until eventually, if we practice this thoroughly and long enough, all that is within us is purity. And all that is within us is goodness. But there's more to it than just the outer environment. There's an inner environment too. And that inner environment is what we'll be talking about next week when we talk about the five Buddha wisdoms and how those five Buddha wisdoms manifest within us, our inner environment. This is the outer environment. This room symbolizes the outer environment of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. But there's also an inner environment, and we'll be talking about that next week. I'm a little embarrassed because the talk ended up being way shorter than I meant for it to be. But this will give us at least a few minutes to have some discussion, and you can think about questions you might have about mantra practice, questions that you might have about bok, chok. I just love that. I love the Tibetan language because it's very evocative. there's a phrase in Tibetan that is talking about calling out to the Buddhas for help. And the word for that in Tibetan is hlong hlong, which sounds sad already. Hlong hlong. Yeah. Anyway, I just love the Tibetan language and things you can learn from it. Anyway, I think that Bok Chok is a really marvelous topic, and we will be doing more on it as time goes along. Because what this means is if all we're doing all day, every day, is making habitual tendencies, and those habitual tendencies are the glue that hold our mind and being together. If that's what Bok Chok is, then what we do and how we make it is very important. Because in the book, in the Karma book, I'll say one more thing, then we'll open it up for questions. In the book, Karma, What It Is, What It Isn't, and Why It Matters by Trolok Rinpoche, he said that the Buddha did not teach that we have a material soul. You know, he didn't teach a material soul made of atoms or molecules that was created by someone and so forth. He taught instead something he called a stream of being, that is our thoughts, feelings, emotions, and all of our experience of ourself and the world. That stream of being is like a literal stream. They say you can't put your foot in the same river twice. Well, that's because our stream of being is changing continuously. And what holds that stream of being together that makes us us is our Bok Chok, is our habitual patterns and tendencies. They start out being very selfish, and then they become less so, and then eventually we go beyond selfish habits altogether. That's the way Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said. He said, as people, we start with a lot of bad habits, and then we replace the bad habits with good habits, and then we go beyond habit and into Buddhahood. So we can talk about that next time, because I think that's going to take a while to explain. So thank you for letting me experiment with this talk today. I experimented a little bit talking about the room and imagining that we're in it, and here we are. So if anybody has questions or thoughts or want to ask a question about anything other than this, you can use the question microphone so everybody can hear, and even the folks at home on Zoom, if they have questions, they can ask also. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we.
Hi.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, I have to encourage people that even though it's a little scary to hear your voice on the PA system, it is better if you get closer to the mic.
Okay.
Thank you.
A little too close. So, what does the script? I see writing on the red line.
Oh yeah.
What does that script mean?
The script is the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, the compassion mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, and it is it's just repeated all the way around. And this particular style of I'm calling it iconography. That's not the right word. It's calligraphy. This particular style of calligraphy has a name, and I'm going to mispronounce it, but I think it's Lanza, L-A-N-Z-A. I think it's Lanza, but I may be mispronouncing that. But it's a specific style of calligraphy that makes it look more like Sanskrit than Tibetan.
Okay.
I forget which of the sutras it was, but one of the sutras of the Buddha said that if you say these names of the Buddha, which is Om Mani Padme Hum, is a form of the name of the Buddha Chenrezig, or the Bodhisattva Chenrezig, Bodhisattva of Compassion, that if you say them or if you put them in public places and so forth, it will cause. See, now here's Bok Chok again. It will cause an imprint on the consciousness of any person who sees it, and it will be like a seed that's planted for their future awakening. So even if people don't know what it means, seeing it will be a seed for future awakening.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Hey, thank you.
As I understand or remember, Bok Chok is a habitual pattern?
Yep. That's
okay. One of my Bok Chas is attempt to be simple, And the other bhakcha of many is curiosity. So my question is there one or more Buddhas alive in the world today? How many? And are there bodhicittas alive in the world today?
Oh, so the question is, are there Buddhas and Bodhisattvas alive in the world today?
Bodhisattvas, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
okay,
yes.
Right, okay. That's the question?
Yeah, and
okay.
Where are they?
Yeah, that's an extreme, where are they? Why aren't they showing up here, right? Well, you know what's really interesting is that Kempo Kartha Rinpoche once, because we asked him this, and he said, only Buddhas and Bodhisattvas can tell you who is a Buddha and who is a Bodhisattva, because the rest of us just look at their behavior and say, they got pretty good behavior. They must be a Buddha or something, you know, because we don't really know. We can't really see. Rinpoche said that right now, because we're not enlightened beings, we can't see into the minds or the thoughts of other people. So it's impossible for us to know. But the likelihood of there being Buddhas and Bodhisattvas among us at any time, it's good. It's a good, because over the ages and ages in which Dharma has been taught in so many places, many beings have achieved enlightenment. And once they achieve enlightenment, they don't fall back and become ordinary again. But it is said, such as in Gampopa's precious ornament of liberation, he says that when a person attains the first level of bodhisattva awakening, they can emanate in 100 different ways, in 100 different places simultaneously, right? Which, you know, for busy people, that's a dream of the future. But even the Buddha himself would not describe what an emanation is or how an emanation works. There were several questions the Buddha refused to answer, and that was one of them, so I can't tell you myself because I don't know. But that doesn't mean that some great worldly person is not an emanation of a Buddha or Bodhisattva, and they don't even know it. And they're working for the betterment of beings in a completely selfless manner. And then there's also what they call created Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which are all these images. They're not the Buddha personally, but they are a representative of that awakening that we can then relate to. So I'm making the assumption that they do exist, but how they exist, I can't tell you because I don't honestly know. Trungpa Rinpoche, he liked to think that these reborn Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are doctors and nurses and researchers and scientists and, entertainers, soldiers. They're everywhere. It was the way he liked to talk about that. Yeah.
Well, I'll come back and emanate another time. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just had a comment about the last question, and then sure. I have a question myself.
Sure.
I remember reading in the book on the Karmapa's lives, one of the previous Karmapas was asked, how many emanations does he have in the world? And he said, in Tibet alone, about half a million, I think that's what he said.
Wow.
Yeah. So my question is, how do you maintain your visualization yourself as a Buddha or Yidam in post-meditation? Do you have any tips about that?
That's cool to know that there are lots of emanations of enlightened beings out running around. That's kind of nice. Gives me some reassurance. And so the question was how to work on post-meditation practice as a Buddha or Bodhisattva.
Any tips?
Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said, this takes time. This takes time and practice. And so from my point of view, it starts out being very episodic, very, very start and stop. Because if we look at how we are when we sit and do shamatha meditation, our shamatha meditation is start and stop, start and stop, start and stop, right? Because I don't know about you, but sometimes when I sit down to meditate, I can follow my breath for about 30 seconds and then I'm somewhere else. So, you know, then you have to return your attention to the object and have a fresh start, right? So because your shamatha practice, your calm abiding practice is start and stop, your practice of visualizing yourself as a Buddha and Bodhisattva is going to be start and stop, start and stop, start and stop. But what Rinpoche said you can do is try to maintain awareness throughout the day by momentarily stopping what you're doing, mentally stopping what you're doing, and then imagining that the way he put it was, imagine that you have the illusory body of a Buddha or Bodhisattva and that you are benefiting beings with what you are doing. Which means that you could like imagine that you're a Buddha or Bodhisattva picking the kids up from school, or you can be a Buddha or Bodhisattva washing the dishes or cleaning the house. You can have like a Bodhisattva moment, right? You can, and this is how he said you get into the habit of doing it. He also said you can get in the habit of visualizing yourself as a Buddha or Bodhisattva when you're undergoing an intense experience. Like if you have sudden pain, or if you feel suddenly embarrassed about something, or you have like this like emotional tug, like where you feel like really weird, you know, you're just like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed, I could just explode. Those are really good moments to visualize yourself as a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And at one point in my life, I had a problem with panic attacks. And I don't know if anybody else can relate to this, but they're really scary when they first start happening and you don't know what they are. So of course, I ask a lama. The lama I happened to meet was Lama Namse. I said, well, what would you do? You know, what would you recommend? And he says, I'll tell you what I think would work really well. He said, is just close your eyes while it's happening. Close your eyes and imagine yourself as a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, but imagine that your body made of light and empty inside, that light-made body, imagine that it's as big as a mountain, huge, filling all of space. And then that actually worked because that expansion, that sudden expansion, because I think panic has to do with closing in. Everything's closing in, closing in, closing in. But then this is a complete opposite of that. It's just opening, opening, opening. And so it worked. So those are the only pieces of advice I've received, which is to recognize that it's episodic, to make it happen a few times a day. And it's easy to do it when you're like standing in line waiting for something, or you're sitting in your car waiting for something. You can just take a moment and imagine that you have the body, speech, and mind of the Buddha or Bodhisattva.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we have a question from the internet. Hello, internet.
Hello. Is the palace you've been referring to the same thing as a mandala?
The palace, is it the same as a mandala? The answer is, yeah, it is. Because if you think about it, the first part of the visualization was circular, right? There's this big circle that is like has a vajra fence around it that's then covered with a dome-shaped tent. There's more to it than that, but I decided not to try to break your brain today. Because you can get super complex about that with the four colors on the floor, and they're all made of interlocking vajras, so it's really complicated. But that is the circle that you frequently see depicted in a mandala drawing. That's the circle. And it's, by the way, covered in flames which usually are depicted as swirls at the outside of the circle. And then you actually will see the Vajra fence depicted as small Vajras that are drawn in the inner circle. And then it gets closer and closer and closer, and then the square begins. The square begins in the center of that, and it has the four porticos and the four doors, you know, east, south, west, and north. And so, and then the very, very center, there's usually either a seed syllable or a Buddha. So that's it. And so the word mandala has a special meaning. It means center and surrounding. Center and surrounding, because that's what a mandala drawing is. It's a Buddha, which is the center, and the Buddha's surrounding, which is the pure realm in the palace. And so this is where we're going to go next week, because Kempa Rinpoche said, if you think about it, you currently have a mandala as an ordinary person. You just call it the place you reside, your family, your friends, your coworkers, your stuff. That's your current mandala. But you could, if you become a Buddha, then it's going to be an awakened mandala, full of virtue and goodness and wisdom and love and compassion. So, yeah, we're working on it. Thank you. Great question. We have time for a couple more, if there's a couple more out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi there.
I was a little confused during that visualization.
Yeah, it's not surprising, because I think I did it badly.
I couldn't figure out how to transition from being in the tent with the colors around me into the shrine.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was an experiment. I had never done anything like that before, and the way it's explained in the book is good. But I could have changed it a bit to make it easier for folks, the transition, because. This is how many of these Buddha and Bodhisattva mantra practices begin, with the phrase Om Swabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma Swabhava Shuddha Hung, and then all we think of everything as being emptiness, and then from that emptiness arises a sound or a seed syllable that then becomes the protection circle, which is as vast as space. And then in the center of that is another sound that produces the palace. And I didn't make the connection fast enough or well enough.
Well, I encourage us to do that again sometime.
I'll work on it. Yeah, I appreciate it, because I think the coolest thing is, I think I will work on it, because I think this would be fun for like school groups, you know, to explain the iconography of the, you know, to say, imagine that you're in a palace, and then open your eyes and here you are.
I took my grandson when he was about 5 into our previous building, and he looked around and he said, are they getting ready for a birthday party?
And the answer is, yeah, yours. Yeah, you're going to be born as a Buddha. Yeah, isn't that sweet? Are they getting ready for a birthday party? I like that. Hi.
Hi, morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is more of a comment, but the Wexner Center right now has a really great piece. There's apparently a group, I think, in California that does meditation, but they do it underwater, and they basically get all geared up in their scuba gear.
Wow.
And then they meditate underwater, and there's a video installation, if you get a chance to go to it, that's just absolutely gorgeous, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, could you say that a little closer to the microphone, because...
Yeah, the Wexner Center has a really great show on meditation right now.
The Wexner Center?
At OSU, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I just wanted to let people know about that, because it was really, it was very powerful. So just to share that.
You know, I really appreciate you talking about this, because I think that the reason these forms of art exist is to sort of take us out of our mundane way of looking at things, our usual, maybe confused way of looking at things, and momentarily placing us somewhere else so that we can think about things differently for just a moment. And I think that's what film does, that's what literature does, is it kind of momentarily takes us out of the mundane reality shows us something interesting and then replaces us back in where we started. But we're not back where we started, because every one of these experiences expands our horizon just a little bit. So we're not exactly the same person when they deposit us back at the door as we were when they took us in. And I think that's true of all art, dance, theater, all movies, all of that. Even a jazz solo is you take off from a place and they take you somewhere and then they drop you back in the melody where they left you. But you're different. I really appreciate you telling me about that. Now I'm going to go check it out.
Yeah, please do. It's gorgeous.
There's also a wonderful art gallery in New York City that I visited just once. You know, it's the Rubin Museum of Himalayan Art, and they do a similar kind of thing where they have programming that reflects the art. So that's cool. Yeah, thanks. Well, I don't want to overstay my welcome, but if there's one more question out there. Yeah, we got one.
Yeah, I hope I'm not getting too technical, but is bokchak a synonym of klesha?
You know, I'm going to say it's different than, yeah, because we're getting into a semantics discussion here that where this is kind of like I'm a little bit out of my depth, but I'll give it a shot because I think it's an interesting question. So even if I can't answer it, it's interesting to talk about.
I think klesha is Sanskrit.
Klesha is Sanskrit, right? And you know, I'm going to have to have we don't have any ringers in the room here, people who are hidden Tibetan scholars. We don't have any. I'm going to have to look that up to tell you the truth, okay? I think there's a subtle difference between the meaning of the word, I think there's a subtle difference in the meaning of the word klesha and the meaning of the Tibetan, which is a Sanskrit word, which means mental affliction. That's what kleshas are, mental afflictions. And I think there's a subtle difference between that and habitual tendency. Because if we look at the discussion of the four veils that cover our Buddha nature, which is where we're going to start next week, we have the veil of basic ignorance, meaning we don't know we have Buddha nature, and that kind of makes it hard to find Buddha nature if you don't even know you have it. So that's the first problem. Second problem is habitual tendencies. Third problem is mental afflictions, which come from habitual tendencies. And then the last is karmic accumulation. But I will check in with my Tibetan friends and find out if there's, you know, what the exact difference is between those two words. In fact, I better make a note about that, because if I don't, I'm going to walk through my whole week and then get to Sunday and forget I said I'd look that up. So klesha and bokchak, I'll check it out. Yeah, so thank you. And I think we have another question. Hey, yeah, these are good questions, by the way. These are excellent questions.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Yeah, no, thank you.
I have a question. When I the very first time I did the Mantrayana.
You may have to get closer to the microphone.
When I first did the Mantrayana sadhana, it was quite difficult.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if there's some way to ease into it, if you have any suggestions. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Let me see if I understand the question. Okay, see if I understand the question. You said the very first time you practiced a sadhana, doesn't matter which one, just any sadhana, you had trouble, right?
Yes.
Because it was complicated, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Was that the reason?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, I get that. I get that. And how do you approach it? Okay.
Right.
Well, here's something. I think you're right about that, because this morning we sat in on Medicine Buddha for the first time. There was someone who sat in for the first time in Medicine Buddha, and it's a chunk. It's a lot. There's chanting and there's a mantra and all that kind of stuff, and we didn't really even get that into the visualization that much. So here's what I tell people if they're interested in learning a sadhana. Like Chenrezig or Medicine Buddha or Tara that we do on a regular basis here, that if you approach it the way we approach creating theater, that can help. For example, in a play, if you're putting on a play, you start with the words. You learn the words of the play. And then secondly, you learn how to move around the stage to create the illusion that the play is really happening, that what's being described in the play is really happening somewhere. And then finally, you have to add in the character's emotions. Because when you're just reading, if you're reading flat words that have no emotion, it's like, you know, it's there's not much going on there. But when you add words to the movement and the emotion, then you have the illusion of life that's either film, literature, or play. And so what I tell people is start by reading the sadhana in English. Just read it in English every day. Read it and read it and read it and read it until the words, you know, you kind of know what follows what. You know, this part is here and then this part and then this part. So first I would stick with the words and the meaning of the words and really chew on them and get to know them. And then I would sit down with a teacher and have the teacher walk you through the visualizations that go with the words. And then you can add in the, and then after you get that kind of established, because sometimes what you have to do is wait until you're reciting the mantra, because you can't do the visualizations while you are chanting about the visualizations. Like in Chenrezig, the first part of Chenrezig is that there's above the top of your head and all sentient beings is the seed syllable Hri. Well, most people can't be reading that and visualizing it at the same time. That takes a lot of time. But if you get to the mantra, then you can go back and create the visualization gradually while you're reciting the mantra. It gives you some brain time to kind of go back and fill in the visualization. And then gradually you'll be able to do it simultaneous to reading it. So I tell people, number one, be patient and recognize that it's going to take time, that you have to kind of invest some of yourself in creating this sacred world, and that you're in it to learn it, and it doesn't matter how long it takes you. Don't be impatient, because it takes a long time. I don't know if any of those things are helpful. Did that answer your question?
Yes, that did. It did. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, because it seems exotic. These kinds of practices seem exotic, and they seem complex. And what I tell people is that life is complex. Every facet of our life, you know, from the books we read to the activities we undertake, the games we play, all of the things we do are very complicated. And so mantra practice is itself complicated in order to replace the mundane, confused appearances with sacred appearances and sacred complexity. And then eventually we go beyond that. But that takes time. And so that's the function of it, to replace the mundane with the sacred and then to go beyond even those ideas. But the coolest part for me about mantra practice is that moment of recognition where I get to pretend to be an enlightened being for just a few minutes. That's kind of nice. It gives me the idea of what it must be like to be an enlightened, what it must be like to be able to benefit beings just by existing. Wow, that's pretty cool. Anyway, we'll stop here for today, and I thank you for your attention and your patience as I tried new ideas out, you know. I hope that during this week you'll take a minute or two to think about your own environment, your own mandala, and pay attention to your own mandala and say, I hope that someday my personal mandala becomes an awakened mandala. It's kind of, even if all you do is make an aspiration for that this week, it's going to be good. We gather together all the goodness, and we'll use the words of dedication here to have a lot of blessing. By the way, some people have asked about the second stanza of our dedication where it mentions Manjushri, whose name is misspelled here, and Samantabhadra, whose name is not misspelled, but you may not know who Samantabhadra is. Manjushri and Samantabhadra are two of the eight great bodhisattvas of the Buddhist tradition. And Manjushri is about wisdom, and Samantabhadra is about generosity and giving. And Samantabhadra was famous for making offerings to the Buddhas and bodhisattvas with a very pure attitude. And so we mention them, we essentially name check them, you know, we sort of name check them here as a way of calling upon them to be good examples for us. You know, like these two great bodhisattvas, like they dedicated, I'd like to dedicate like they dedicated. And what it does is it purifies any selfishness that might be in our dedication. By name-checking them and by invoking them, we make the aspiration that we can be like them someday. So anyway, you can always rely on me for Vajrayana trivia. I'm here for you. Gathering together all the goodness we created today and dedicating it, we'll use the words by this merit. We'll start with that. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. And I'll recite it in Tibetan. Orso nam dihi tam che zipani, tom ne ne pedra nam pam jene, ke ga na chi pa lap tru pahi, si pe so le tro wa tro wa sho jam pa pa wo ji ta ken pa tang kun tu sam po te yan te jin te de da kun ki che su ta lo ching ke wa di ta tam che rap tu ngô. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Thank you to the folks at home and to the team, the Zoom team. So thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.